The Constitution has always been remarkable for the felicity of its arrangement of different subjects and the perspicuity and appropriateness of the language it uses. But if this clause is construed to extend to territory acquired by the present government from a foreign nation, outside of the limits of any charter from the British government to a colony, it would be difficult to say why it was deemed necessary to give the government the power to sell any vacant lands belonging to the sovereignty which might be found within it, and if this was necessary, why the grant of this power should precede the power to legislate over it and establish a government there, and still more difficult to say why it was deemed necessary so specially and particularly to grant the power to make needful rules and regulations in relation to any personal or movable property it might acquire there. For the words other property necessarily, by every known rule of interpretation, must mean property of a different description from territory or land. And the difficulty would perhaps be insurmountable in endeavoring to account for the last member of the sentence, which provides that nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or any particular state, or to say how any particular state could have claims in or to a territory ceded by a foreign government, or to account for associating this provision with the preceding provisions of the clause with which it would appear to have no connection. The words needful rules and regulations would seem also to have been cautiously used for some definite object. They are not the words usually employed by statesmen when they mean to give the powers of sovereignty or to establish a government or to authorize its establishment. And thus, in the law to renew and keep alive the ordinance of 1787 and to reestablish the government, the title of the law is An Act to Provide for the Government of the Territory Northwest of the River Ohio. And in the Constitution, when granting the power to legislate over the territory that may be selected for the seat of government independently of a state, it does not say Congress shall have the power to make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory, but it declares that Congress shall have power to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over the district, not exceeding 10 miles square, as may by cession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of the government of the United States. The words rules and regulations are usually employed in the Constitution in speaking of some particular specified power which it means to confer on the government, and not, as we have seen, when granting general powers of legislation. As, for example, in the particular power to Congress to make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces, or the particular and specific power to regulate commerce, to establish a uniform rule of naturalization, to coin money and regulate the value thereof. And to construe the words of which we are speaking as a general and unlimited grant of sovereignty over territories which the government might afterwards acquire is to use them in a sense and for a purpose for which they were not used in any other part of the instrument. But if confined to a particular territory in which a government and laws had already been established, but which would require some alterations to adapt it to the new government, the words are peculiarly applicable and appropriate for that purpose. The necessity of this special provision in relation to property and the rights or property held in common by the Confederated States is illustrated by the first clause of the sixth article. This clause provides that all debts, contracts, and engagements entered into before the adoption of this Constitution shall be as valid against the United States under this government as under the Confederation. This provision, like the one under consideration, was indispensable if a new Constitution was adopted. The new government was not a mere change in a dynasty or in a form of government, leaving the nation or sovereignty the same and clothed with all the rights and bound by all the obligations of the preceding one. But when the present United States came into existence under the new government, it was a new political body, a new nation, then for the first time taking its place in the family of nations. It took nothing by succession from the Confederation. It had no right as its successor to any property or rights of property which it had acquired, and it was not liable for any of its obligations. It was evidently viewed in this light by the framers of the Constitution. And as the several states would cease to exist in their former confederated character upon the adoption of the Constitution, and could not in that character again assemble together, special provisions were indispensable to transfer to the new government the property and rights which at that time they held in common, and at the same time to authorize it to lay taxes and appropriate money to pay the common debt which they had contracted. And this power could only be given to it by special provisions in the Constitution. The clause in relation to the territory and other property of the United States provided for the first, and the clause last quoted provided for the other. They have no connection with the general powers and rights of sovereignty delegated to the new government, and can neither enlarge nor diminish them. They were inserted to meet a present emergency and not to regulate its powers as a government. Indeed, a similar provision was deemed necessary in relation to treaties made by the Confederation. And when in the clause next succeeding the one of which we have last spoken, it is declared that treaties shall be the supreme law of the land, care is taken to include by express words the treaties made by the Confederated States. The language is, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. Whether, therefore, we take the particular clause in question by itself or in connection with the other provisions of the Constitution, we think it clear that it applies only to the particular territory of which we have spoken and cannot, by any just rule of interpretation, be extended to territory which the new government might afterwards obtain from a foreign nation. Consequently, the power which Congress may have lawfully exercised in this territory while it remained under a territorial government and which may have been sanctioned by judicial decision can furnish no justification and no argument to support a similar exercise of power over territory afterwards acquired by the federal government. We put aside, therefore, any argument drawn from precedents showing the extent of the power which the general government exercised over slavery in this territory as altogether inapplicable to the case before us. But the case of the American and Ocean Insurance Companies v. Cantor has been quoted as establishing a different construction of this clause of the Constitution. There is, however, not the slightest conflict between the opinion now given and the one referred to, and it is only by taking a single sentence out of the latter and separating it from the context that even an appearance of conflict can be shown. We need not comment on such a mode of expounding an opinion of the court. Indeed, it most commonly misrepresents instead of expounding it. And this is fully exemplified in the case referred to, where if one sentence is taken by itself, the opinion would appear to be in direct conflict with that now given. But the words which immediately follow that sentence show that the court did not mean to decide the point, but merely affirmed the power of Congress to establish a government in the territory, leaving it an open question whether that power was derived from this clause in the Constitution or was to be necessarily inferred from a power to acquire territory by cession from a foreign government. The opinion on this part of the case is short, and we give the whole of it to show how well the selection of a single sentence is calculated to mislead. The court, in speaking of the power of Congress to establish a territorial government in Florida until it should become a state, uses the following language. In the meantime, Florida continues to be a territory of the United States governed by that clause of the Constitution which empowers Congress to make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property of the United States. Perhaps the power of governing a territory belonging to the United States, which has not, by becoming a state, acquired the means of self-government, may result necessarily from the fact that it is not within the jurisdiction of any particular state and is within the power and jurisdiction of the United States. The right to govern may be the inevitable consequence of the right to acquire territory. Whichever may be the source from which the power is derived, the possession of it is unquestionable. It is thus clear from the whole opinion on this point that the court did not mean to decide whether the power was derived from the clause in the Constitution or was the necessary consequence of the right to acquire. They do decide that the power in Congress is unquestionable, and in this we entirely concur. And nothing will be found in this opinion to the contrary. The power stands firmly on the latter alternative put by the court, that is, as the inevitable consequence of the right to acquire territory. And what still more clearly demonstrates that the court did not mean to decide the question but leave it open for future consideration is the fact that the case was decided in the circuit court by Mr. Justice Johnson and his decision was affirmed by the Supreme Court. His opinion at the circuit is given in full in a note to the case, and in that opinion he states in explicit terms that the clause of the Constitution applies only to the territory then within the limits of the United States and not to Florida, which had been acquired by cession from Spain. This part of his opinion will be found in the note in page 517 of the report, but he does not dissent from the opinion of the Supreme Court, thereby showing that in his judgment, as well as that of the court, The case before them did not call for a decision on that particular point, and the court abstained from deciding it. And in a part of its opinion, subsequent to the passage we've quoted, where the courts speak of the legislative power of Congress in Florida, they still speak with the same reserve. And in page 546, speaking of the power of Congress to authorize the territorial legislature to establish courts there, the courts say, they are legislative courts created in virtue of the right of sovereignty which exists in the government, or in virtue of that clause which enables Congress to make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory belonging to the United States. It has been said that the construction given to this clause is new and now for the first time brought forward. The case of which we are speaking and which has been so much discussed shows that the fact is otherwise. It shows that precisely the same question came before Mr. Justice Johnson at his circuit 30 years ago, was fully considered by him, and the same construction given to the clause in the Constitution, which is now given by this court. And that upon an appeal from his decision, the same question was brought before this court, but was not decided because a decision upon it was not required by the case before the court. There is another sentence in the opinion which has been commented on, which even in a still more striking manner shows how one may mislead or be misled by taking out a single sentence from the opinion of the court and leaving out of view what precedes and follows. It is in page 546, near the close of the opinion, in which the courts say, in legislating for them, the territories of the United States, Congress exercises the combined powers of the general and of a state government. And it is said that as a state may unquestionably prohibit slavery within its territory, this sentence decides, in effect, that Congress may do the same in a territory of the United States, exercising there the powers of a state as well as the power of the general government. The examination of this passage in the case referred to would be more appropriate when we came to consider in another part of this opinion what power Congress can constitutionally exercise in a territory over the rights of person or rights of property of a citizen. But as it is in the same case with the passage we have before commented on, we dispose of it now, as it will save the court from the necessity of referring again to the case. And it will be seen upon reading the page in which this sentence is found that it has no reference whatever to the power of Congress over rights of person or rights of property, but relates altogether to the power of establishing judicial tribunals to administer the laws constitutionally passed and defining the jurisdiction they may exercise. The law of Congress establishing a territorial government in Florida provided that the legislature of the territory should have legislative powers over all rightful objects of the legislation, but no law should be valid which was inconsistent with the laws and Constitution of the United States. Under the power thus conferred, the legislature of Florida passed an act erecting a tribunal at Key West to decide cases of salvage. And in the case of which we are speaking, the question arose whether the territorial legislature could be authorized by Congress to establish such a tribunal with such powers. And one of the parties, among other objections, insisted that Congress could not, under the Constitution, authorize the legislature of the territory to establish such a tribunal with such powers, but that it must be established by Congress itself, and that a sale of cargo made under its order to pay salvors was void, as made without legal authority, and passed no property to the purchaser. It is in disposing of this objection that the sentence relied on occurs, and the court began that part of the opinion by stating with great precision the point which they are about to decide. They say, it has been contended that by the Constitution of the United States, the judicial power of the United States extends to all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, and that the whole of the judicial power must be vested in one Supreme Court, and in such inferior courts as Congress shall from time to time ordain and establish. Hence it has been argued that Congress cannot vest admiralty jurisdiction in courts created by the territorial legislature. And after thus clearly stating the point before them, and which they were about to decide, they proceed to show that these territorial tribunals were not constitutional courts, but merely legislative, and that Congress might therefore delegate the power to the territorial government to establish the court in question. And they conclude that part of the opinion in the following words. Although admiralty jurisdiction can be exercised in the states and those courts only which are established in pursuance of the third article of the Constitution, the same limitation does not extend to the territories. In legislating for them, Congress exercises the combined powers of the general and state governments.